Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Raise your hand if you would enjoy dating or marrying someone who makes more money than you. I mean, bonus, right?
In the beginning, I think they enjoy it. It's like, oh, great, I'm special. This is fabulous. But, you know, then when you look back in hindsight, it's like,
Yeah, how many of you men raised your hand? Oh, we got to talk. And we will. Most assuredly, this next guy makes more money than most of us. And most of us will never top the manner in which he teaches his medical students.
Hypercellular with apoptotic nuclei. A small blue cell, a tumor with little cytoplasm.
The singing neuropathologist, and so much more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. We preach the gospel of index funds. It's the personal finance version of set it and forget it. Tie your investments to the overall market instead of trying to cherry pick the best stocks. The only real decision you have to make is which index funds to go with. And believe me, they all want you. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
This week we're featuring a grudge match, a catfight, a 15-round pay-per-view battle to the bell over index funds. In one corner, Fidelity Investments. In the other, Vanguard. Fidelity is trying to beef up its share of the business, and that growth could come at the expense of Vanguard. All this over something that doesn't usually generate a whole lot of money. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to put her finger on the index fund wars.
It started quietly enough. Fidelity slashed the fees on its index funds 4 years ago. Since then, Fidelity has nearly doubled the money in its index funds to about $85 billion. That's still dwarfed by the $600 billion in Vanguard's index funds.
Come on, I'm with you.
So, Fidelity took out full-page ads recently. The headline, Attention Vanguard Index Fund Owners. Fidelity has index funds with lower expenses.
Part of it is, you know, to hit a competitor, a fierce rival, where it hurts, you know, saying, oh, you say you're the low-cost leader in mutual funds? Well, we offer lower index funds, so there.
Dan Culleton is a senior mutual fund analyst with Morningstar. He says Fidelity and Vanguard aren't dueling over crumbs. Even low fees can add up if you have enough customers. And index funds are easy. They just follow an index, say the S&P 500. Computers do a lot of the work. Dan Wiener edits the independent advisor for Vanguard Investors.
You don't need to have a big research department. You don't need analysts speaking to corporate management, digging into the financials.
But Fidelity isn't getting rid of the high-priced experts who manage its traditional mutual funds. After all, that's where most people have their money invested. Morningstar's Dan Culleton says Fidelity could be using index funds as a loss leader.
You know, attempt to get new investors in the door, you know, to sample its other financial services offerings, its other mutual funds.
Of course, those other funds have higher fees. Will the new Fidelity campaign work? I tracked out to the suburban Washington office of financial planner Steve Wiseman to find out.
We're going to have a new client coming in this morning.
Wiseman told me Fidelity might pick up new customers, but from brokerage houses.
So it might be that people that were with, let's say, the Merrill Lynch's, the Smith Barney, the UBS's, Fidelity will pick up its share from that.
Wiseman says Vanguard investors are loyal. They won't sell the company down the river. And Vanguard isn't about to let its customers float away. So the dueling will continue, although it may end in a draw. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace Money.
You want to play another one?
Give him a couple of bucks.
Thank you. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivin Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivin.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org.
You've heard us talk before about the credit rating companies, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch. Investors rely on their ratings to determine if a security or bond is worth buying. Well, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, is exploring, among other things, whether those ratings should also come with a ranking about how risky the investment is. That way, maybe the entire world wouldn't be so quick to buy into things like structured investment vehicles and collateralized debt obligations. Eric Talley teaches corporate law at UC Berkeley. And Eric, what other reforms is the SEC looking into?
Most of the smart money seems to be on additional reforms regarding disclosure about conflicts of interest with respect to the companies they rate, maybe greater separation between sort of the traditional things that ratings agencies place their seal of approval on and more exotic, recent structured finance sorts of investments.
So this would be, say, the mortgage-backed securities that we all know and love.
And indeed, these have been blamed at least for much of the current crisis regarding the debt crisis in general. And, you know, the ratings agencies played a big role in putting an investment grade stamp on a lot of these mortgage-backed securities. And so the questions about how they went about rating these structured finance products, which, by the way, are really just sort of repackaged mortgages, sliced and diced and julienned in a way that makes some aspects of them safe and some more risky, is going to be a real issue.
Should the average investor be worried about ratings?
It's quite possible that a lot of these investment products are going to be downgraded. And obviously, the big immediate losers when that happens are owners of those securities. A particularly painful blow is going to come to brokers and dealers and investment banks. But in addition, many people hold structured investments without even realizing it, through their pension plans, through their municipalities. And this third victim is one of sort of the unanticipated costs. That could cause people to pull back generally with greater and greater skepticism from the debt market, and that can create sort of a seizure within the debt market that's even worse than what we've experienced so far.
So the credit crunch could even get worse if this system is tightened up?
It's at least conceivable that in the short term it could get worse. The goal here is that this short-term pain might be made up for by long-term gain. So that's sort of the hope here, is that tightening up the standards that apply to a lot of these rating firms is actually going to yield long-term dividends for everyone.
Eric, you know, I remember after the WorldCom and Enron and Adelphia debacles where the rating agencies also, again, came under great scrutiny, there was all kinds of talk that they were going to fix the system. Well, then a couple of years later, you had the housing boom, and all of a sudden the rating agencies are slapping AAA on dubious investment products. Do you think that this time they may actually fix the system?
They may try to fix it. Remember, you know, one of the biggest attributes of a lot of public policy making is the enterprise of solving yesterday's problems tomorrow. And so we don't really know whether the move that's going forward right now is going to have the ultimate effects that everyone hopes it will. And remember, like all of us, the ratings agencies probably didn't fully understand how a lot of these structured products work. And the housing bubble and the housing boom certainly fed that enterprise. You know, the hope is that the ratings agencies will emerge a much more transparent, much less conflicted group of firms, maybe even less dominated by three key players. And ultimately, that probably would serve not only people who are attempting to borrow money, but also general investors like you and me.
Given that we all rely on these rating agencies for our investments and they have quite a bit of power, does it bother you at all that they didn't understand what they were giving their stamp of approval to?
I guess it bothers me, but you have to realize that even experts in finance can't really agree to this day about how you should understand the default risk in a lot of these products. So I think if that were the issue alone, I suspect people would be willing to cut the ratings agencies a fair amount of slack. I think when you add to that growing perceptions about some potential conflicts of interest led to this sort of aggregation of a desire to investigate further.
Eric Talley is a professor of law at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Thanks so much for your help today.
Glad to be here, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, joins us for the audio op-ed that we call The Straight Story. And Chris, some pretty amazing news this week about a potential settlement regarding credit reports and credit scores. It looks like TransUnion has settled a big class action lawsuit. They're calling it the biggest class action settlement in history. And folks will be getting the option of getting free credit reports and credit scores. And the scores have never been free before.
All I can say is it's about time. Or maybe I should say hallelujah. It's about time. Now, there are certain restrictions to this because it's only going to last for, 6 to 9 months, depending on which service you choose. But I think it's very good news that consumers are going to get their credit score for free. And my prediction is that this is a precursor. This is a fundamental shift in the industry. Yes, it's a settlement, short period of time, only involves TransUnion. It doesn't involve the other two major credit reporting bureaus. But I have a feeling this is going to change going forward.
Well, and I guess the real big change here is that a law was passed a couple of years ago where you can get your credit reports for free once a year from each of those three agencies. But the credit score, you've always still had to pay for. Isn't it almost more important than the reports themselves?
Yes. I mean, look, it's valuable information. I mean, the reason why I'm saying I think that in the future, I don't know, maybe over the next year or so, the credit score is going to become free and accessible is just what you mentioned. You know, there were years when you had to pay for your credit report. It was a real frustration because this is powerful information. It affects your borrowing, the rate that you borrow, whether you're going to get a good rate on that mortgage or that auto loan. There's a lot of frustration. And finally, the federal government came in and said, look, once a year, you can get a free report. Now, my feeling is we're going to have the exact same thing happen with the credit score. It's not a revolution. This isn't going to change all that much. But if that number is going to exist, you and I should know what it is whenever we want to know.
And I also wanted to address another element of this settlement, which I would find very helpful. As you said, it only lasts, 6 months under the settlement. But if you sign up for this service, it will notify you by email if there are changes to your credit file. And that would include if there are late payments that are flagged. And for those of us who have found out about accidental late payments or non-payments, this would be a huge benefit.
You know, what may be happening, to a large extent, if you look at the credit reporting bureaus, they don't care about you and me.
No.
They're designed for business. What you just talked about, that's a service that's valuable to the consumer. It changes the customer base. And so one of the things that I hope is going to happen over a period of time is that if the credit reporting agencies and the credit scores are going to have all this power, more of it should be directed toward improving consumer information and consumer knowledge and less worrying about whether or not a lender can slice and dice its customer base.
All right. The Straight Story from our own Chris Farrell. Chris, all credit to you.
Hey, and you know what? I'm looking forward to getting a free credit score.
Coming up, hey, what's your take on work versus marriage?
And I knew these were stupid, stupid, dumb ideas. Like somehow you can have one thing or the other. You can have a career or you can have a man. It's not true.
Amen. But really? We're still debating this? Really? And we've got some welcome news for house hunters. Stay tuned for more Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Carrie, Cosmos, and Manolos are back. This weekend, the women of Sex and the City hit the big screen. Now, they've certainly had their share of debates about money and men. Carrie's Mr. Big makes big dough. Miranda, the high-powered lawyer, has always made more money than husband Steve. But a recent report based on census data showed that even today, in an age of a fully viable female presidential candidate, women who out-earned their male suitors made them feel uncomfortable and inadequate. We asked Marketplace's Sean Cole to look into it, and he ended up feeling a little inadequate himself.
My plan was to call up five women who make a lot of money and ask them about their dating woes. And this plan made my friend Pagan Kennedy, another journalist, really mad.
And what I just get frustrated by is when editors create these trend stories and find five women who can't meet a boyfriend, when they do that, they're affecting so many women.
Women like her. Pagan doesn't make a lot of money, but she does own a house. And while none of her boyfriends have ever been intimidated by that, including her current one who lives with her, that didn't stop her from worrying they would be.
And I knew these were stupid, stupid, dumb ideas. Like somehow you can have one thing or the other. You can have a career or you can have a man. It's not true. You can always find five people to back up whatever trend story you want to write.
But as it turns out, that's not true either.
Hello.
I didn't just speak with five women. I spoke with six, the narrowest data sample you can imagine. All Bay Area residents, all 41 to 65 years old, earning $75,000 to well over $100,000 a year. Nonetheless, while some of them said their money made some men squirrely,
either they see me as like this ATM machine, or there's a resentment like, I should be making more than you.
Others said the opposite.
When I dated men who make less, my two experiences were that they actually liked that I made more money.
Not only that, but age was a factor. One woman said guys her age have problems with her affluence, but younger guys don't.
In fact, they consider professional success in a woman as an aphrodisiac.
Of course, that opinion wasn't consistent either.
So this is going to be a bit of a difficult piece if you're getting such varying opinions.
Tell me about it. The only thing to do was to present a couple of opposing cases and try to sort of divine the truth that way. So, submitted for your approval, case one, Lynn Rousseau. 45 years old, self-employed. She does work for title and escrow companies. And she says relationships with guys who earn less always kind of follow the same trajectory.
In the beginning, I think they enjoy it. It's like, oh, great, I'm special. This is fabulous. Wow, you know. But, you know, then when you look back in hindsight, it's like, it was great, wasn't it?
Great for them because you make
exactly more. Great for them. Yeah, they're loving it.
Some of the guys have taken advantage of her. So now, on the first date or two, she really plays down what she does for a living. And she certainly doesn't let on that she owns her own place.
And, I mean, I'll actually say, you know, yeah, I've got a lousy landlord, and so I am working that angle.
And she tends to size them up with a little litmus test.
So, you know, we'll go out, and I'll just, you know, the bill comes, I'm just looking around, I'm not making any effort to pay it or split it or anything.
Pagan was not pleased by this example, and she really wanted me to talk to some couple friends of hers who were living happily ever after, even though the women earned more.
I feel like I had so many of them, and now I'm actually letting you and the feminist movement down.
Luckily, I managed to find a couple all on my own. Case number two, Kate and Randy.
I like it if he takes me out once a week. That's nice.
And do you feel like you need to pay for dinner once a week because you're the guy?
Yeah.
They rent an apartment outside Boston. They've been together about 5 years. They're in their mid-20s. And while neither of them earns a ton, and a lot of Kate's paycheck goes to student loans, she makes about 50% more than Randy does. But he's pretty nonchalant about it.
I never got that part of the male-female dynamic where the male had to be the primary breadwinner and the female just did other stuff.
Still, Randy says things would have been different if Kate, say, owned her own house when they met.
That would be really impressive and also very intimidating.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. It's just a level of financial commitment that I can't match at this point in my life.
And he says part of him would wonder whether he was staying with her because of chemistry or because she was financially stable.
Well, and if we think of this in a historic perspective, you know, women have often been objectified, going way back to early arranged marriages and dowries.
Kirby Rossblock is a great person to talk to about gender roles and money. She's the head of research and development at the wealth management firm Genspring, did her dissertation on women and wealth. She says even the very concept of a financial trust has gendery origins.
Well, that goes way, way back to the Middle Ages. Men were going off to fight in the Crusade, and the wife was minding the household. So they put their assets, their farms, their livestock in trust to their neighbor, the male farmer across the way, while they were gone.
Not trusting your wife is how trusts began.
That's actually the irony.
So it's no small wonder that flipping these ancient norms upside down can complicate relationships. But those complications aside, pretty much every guy I talked to told me that they themselves didn't mind their girlfriends or wives earning higher salaries.
I didn't have a problem with it.
I used to be kind of psyched. That's cool.
My fiancé significantly out-earns me, and let me recommend to every man out there that that is the way to go.
Still, in doing this story, I realized that we all have these old patriarchal tapes playing in our heads to some extent. Which brings us back to me and Pagan.
What are the tapes that play in your head?
Well, that I have to pay for the woman on the first date, obviously.
Okay, I mean, Sean, we're going to start you on a whole new program. On your next date, you're going to either wait for the woman to pay or you're going to say, let's go Dutch.
I couldn't do it.
But what if you did?
Then what if she didn't want to hang out with me after that?
Then she probably doesn't want an equal relationship.
And for Pagan, the definition of an equal relationship is going Dutch, on a grand scale, for the rest of your life. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
Well, one thing Sean might eventually decide to go Dutch on is a house. And this week, the National Association of Realtors agreed to share a huge housing database called the MLS with rival brokers on the Internet. Elizabeth Razzie joins us to talk about this settlement with the Justice Department. She is the author of The Fearless Home Buyer. And Liz, what exactly is the MLS?
The Multiple Listing Service is a big database that has almost all of the homes that are available for sale in any given market. The real estate agents created it as a way to offer that I have this property for sale, and if you find a buyer for it, I'll share my commission with you.
So what was the argument against opening up to online brokers?
Part of it was that the realtors didn't want to share this information with anyone. They really preferred to just keep it among themselves, saying, well, this isn't a great big advertising database of homes for sale. This is an offer to do business with fellow real estate agents. But the upstarts who often wanted to get this information really didn't want to play along with that same business model.
What does this change now mean for the average home buyer?
Well, some of the changes have happened just by virtue of the fact that the Department of Justice filed suit. It caused the realtors to modify their position and allow more access to this information. New business models that offer discounts and offer the whole MLS searchable to anyone who wants to sit in their kitchen and look for a home without the obligation of working with a real estate agent, organizations like Redfin.com, Zillow.com to some extent as well. They're just thrilled at this because they now see, you know, their business model is protected and they can advance.
Does this potentially then mean the end of that typical 6% that you have to hand over to the buyers and sellers realtors?
Well, certainly it threatens it. These internet-based discounters who have lower costs built into their system have been whittling away at those commission levels. And now that this issue is resolved, now we can watch and see who else wants to get into this market.
Any tips on kind of who should use the online services and who should stick with a traditional realtor?
Most buyers do a lot of searching online, and there's no reason to limit yourself to one service. And then approach a couple of the agents and see what they will actually give you for your commission. If a real estate agent out there is demanding a full commission of 5 or 6%, you have every right to sit down and say, tell me exactly what you're going to do for that money and justify your commission for me.
All right. Thanks, Elizabeth.
You're welcome.
Elizabeth Razzie is a columnist for The Washington Post and also author of The Fearless Home Buyer and The Fearless Home Seller.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. and by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more online at saveandinvest.org.
It's time once again for Getting Personal, when we help solve your money problems. And with me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello again, Tess.
All right, Chris, let's hit the phones. And our first caller is Josh, and he's from right here in La La Land. Hi, Josh.
Hey, Tess. Hey, Chris.
Should I ask, are you in the business, as they say?
Well, I am in the business, but I work at a nonprofit.
A nonprofit in Hollywood. I didn't know there was such a thing.
I know. It's a rare thing. I'm the director of talent development at Film Independent.
You do the LA Film Festival then?
That's right.
Well, as someone who works at a nonprofit, you obviously have to manage your money well. So what is your question for Chris today?
My question has to do with saving for a child's education. I have a daughter who is not quite two, and I am 45, and I have not started any college savings plan for her, but I need to. Initially, I was planning to set up a 529 account, and I'd been looking into those. And it occurred to me that because of my age, I could do a Roth IRA instead for education, because the funds wouldn't be used until after I turned 59 and a half, and so there wouldn't be any penalty for the withdrawals.
Right.
And as background, I should add that I do have some other retirement funds. So I'm just wondering if this is a terrible idea, a good idea, and I guess the reason why I thought it might be a good idea is because if my daughter should decide not to go to college, the money could be used for something else entirely without any penalty.
All right. Well, Chris, terrible idea or good idea?
Oh, it's a good idea, and I think he's thought it through the right way. And what I like about the idea is it comes under the category of take care of yourself first. So it's very important for parents, no matter how much they want to save for their young child's college education, to really maximize all their options when it comes to retirement savings. Second thing is, who knows what the financial aid system will be in 18 years? So with this strategy, you do have more flexibility, and it is an option that you'll take some of that money and help her pay for college when the time comes.
Mm-hmm.
This may be one of those times when you can have your cake and eat it too. Maximize the Roth, and let's just say at the end of the year you have an extra $100. You can just put that into a 529 plan. Now, it's not going to grow very much. And the way to cut through these 529 plans, the option that I like is what's called age-based investing, which is when your daughter's young, so you have a two-year-old. I don't know the exact numbers, but in the California plan, it will be about 70% stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And then as she nears her college years, the stock portion will be like 30%. It happens automatically, and all you do is you put the $100 in, it gets automatically allocated. And it's a very low-cost, very simple way to save. But I still like your idea of putting the priority on the Roth, maximize that. And then if you got another little bit of money you want to put in the 529 plan, go ahead and do that.
Great.
Well, thanks so much for the call. Good question.
Yeah, thank you.
If you've got a question, visit our website. We're at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link there. Or you can always give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that, by the way, M-O-N-Y. All right, let's reach into the email bag, and Barry writes in from Bellevue, Washington. This year, he and his wife are planning to retire early at the age of 52, but they are moving to another state, and their new home is going to cost about a third of their liquid net worth. They say they have high credit scores and no debt, but are they going to have any problems getting a new mortgage when they do not have a salary?
No, they'll get a mortgage. I mean, the only problems they're going to have getting a mortgage have to do with the current environment that we're in. And think about it this way. You know, typically you have a stream of income off of a salary, and that's most of us. But some people have a stream of income off your assets. That's what they'll be looking at. What's the income stream that is generated by your assets, your savings, your stocks, your bonds, your dividends, your interest payments? And so they'll be looking for an income stream that more than pays for what will be the mortgage burden. But my guess is they're going to perhaps a state with cheaper housing, and they'll be able to do a big down payment. So assuming that the numbers work out, they will be able to get a mortgage. They just have to be able to prove that they can meet the monthly payments.
All right, well, there you go, Barry, and let us know how it goes. Let us know if you were able to get that mortgage. If you need some financial advice, give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there and stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, so we've had the singing detective TV show and movie. We've had TV shows with singing lawyers and cops. And I really hope you caught Scrubs the Musical on NBC.
Hello, I'm Dr. Kelso. I'm delighted that you came. So the doctors say you fainted and you don't know what's to blame.
Well, and don't miss the song about stool samples. But folks, on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we learn singing doctors are not just make-believe.
This song is a highly malignant brain tumor type called primitive neuroectodermal tumor, sung to the tune of Danny Boy.
Oh, primitive neuroectodermal tumor.
My name is Ari Perry. I'm an associate professor in the pathology department at Washington University in St. Louis.
A small blue cell tumor with little cytoplasm.
So when I was a resident, one of the staff made the comment that she didn't think the residents were entertaining enough. And so the next week when I presented one of the tumors to the rest of the staff, after I showed it under the microscope, I pulled out my guitar and sang the first brain tumor song that I had written. And in fact, twice as many people were in the room by the end of the song as at the beginning, because people in the hallway wanted to see what was going on. And later on, when I became a staff attending myself, I thought, you know, this would be a fun way for medical students to learn. Often at the end of each lecture, I will just pick one of the songs and perform it. But the students actually get recordings of these songs on their internal website, and they can listen to them at any point. I've had a lot of positive feedback, people telling me that not only for the test, but later on, they still were able to remember. I have taken lessons kind of on and off for many years. I'm off right now, but it's a lot like medicine. You're never quite there. Always striving for perfection, but you never really reach it. I would say that most neuropathologists make in the range of $100,000 to $250,000 a year. I fall somewhere in the middle of that. My area of specialty in particular is on brain tumors. I look predominantly at brain tumor biopsies under the microscope. So this is the room where frozen tissue is cut into thin sections that you can put on a glass line. The surgeon wants to know where the edge of the tumor is, so this helps them out. I do classical and choral singing with the American Contrari here in St. Louis. And then during the year when I'm teaching medical students, it's more of folk and pop. It's a great distraction from medicine. It's something that helps to release your emotions and your passions. It's kept me sane, basically.
For more ditties from Dr. Ari Perry, go to marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Tom Weber. Break out the bibs and butter, because this lobsterman is swimming against the tide to generate new business.
Fuel is directly related to bait costs. So you have fuel going up, bait going up. You can see the writing on the wall. It's an economic mishap waiting to happen.
And we read from the writing you've left on our wall. Listener letters coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We'll be right back. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. A lot of small businesses are feeling the pinch of the sour economy. Rising food and fuel prices make it tough to eke out profits when the margin is small in the first place. Lobstermen and women are on the list of jobs in deep water. The annual catch is down and market prices are stagnant. Reporter Lenora Chu found two brothers who are clawing back by inviting customers to adopt a lobster trap.
It's a beautiful spring day on the main waterfront. John and Brendan Reddy are heading out on the boat to check their lobster traps. They're hoping for a good catch. Problem is, the lobsters aren't cooperating.
Plenty of seaweed, but no lobsters in this one.
Maine's all annual right. catch was down 15% last year.
Got crabs on this one.
Struck out. Two traps in a row. No lobsters.
Add to that trouble at the marketplace. Prices for lobster have been relatively flat for the last two decades. Meanwhile, John Reddy says the costs of doing business have skyrocketed.
Fuel is directly related to bait costs. So you have fuel going up, bait going up, dockage, that's going up. You can see the writing on the wall. It's an economic mishap waiting to happen.
The Reddys, who are seafood distributors as well as fishermen, knew they needed a different business model. Brendan Reddy.
If you want to be here for 40 years, you can't keep doing something the same way, hoping it's going to change. You have to be proactive.
Their plan is called Catch a Piece of Maine. Here's how it works. Fork over $3,000 and get your own trap for a year. Every lobster that wanders in gets FedEx to your doorstep. The kicker is you get your own private lobsterman. The same guy checks your trap every week and calls you after each shipment. You can even watch him hauling your bounty on an internet video.
We just want to put the face to your harvest is what we want to do.
You're guaranteed 40 lobsters a year, more if your trap is bountiful. And every shipment comes with lobster bibs, cooking instructions, and a helping of steamer clams and mussels. Accountability is also important. You can check your online account anytime to see what's in your trap. John Reddy says it's all about knowing where your food comes from.
Customers today are very, very concerned with sustainability, being green, and traceability. It just so happens that's exactly what we're showing.
The Reddys have sold 200 traps so far and aim to double that by year's end. For the lobstermen, the incentive to join up is clear. The Reddys will pay 40 cents more per pound than the going rate. Lobsterman Kurt Brown.
Lobstermen tend to be very finicky. There's a lot of different options of where to sell your catch, so a price difference of a nickel per pound is enough to make any lobsterman jump from one dealer to the other.
Brown and seven other independent lobstermen have joined up, with many more on the wait list. The business plan seems to be working, but lobster historian Colin Woodard says one innovative idea won't save an industry.
The Reddys are talking about working with up to 400 traps. It's not going to be a solution that's going to buoy up, you know, all 7,000 lobstermen in the state of Maine and the 3.2 million traps that are out there in the water catching lobster.
And competitors say Catch a Piece of Maine is aimed at people with money to burn. Peter McElhaney of New Meadow Seafood in Portland says he can overnight a lobster dinner for a lot less.
These kids come up with a real great idea. You know, you own your own trap, but there's only so many consumers that can afford these type of niches.
The Reddys say they know an industry doesn't change overnight, but for now they found the niche that works for them.
Trap 40.
Back on the boat, things seem to be picking up.
This one right here has a notch. There's a V in its tail. That means we can't keep it. It's illegal.
The notch means it's an egg-producing female. A lobsterman caught it once and marked it forever. Throwing her back in the water helps ensure plenty of baby lobsters will be crawling around in the future. And that future, the Reddys say, is looking up. I'm Lenora Chu for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com.
All right, Chris, we are back with more Getting Personal. And Vic wrote in from Washington, D.C., and he emailed us about a company, and I'm just going to give you the stock symbol. It's MTL. I don't know how this is pronounced because it is a Russia-based mining and steel company. He bought this portfolio through E-Trade, and he recently went onto the website to look at his portfolio, but he's confused about some of the wording that he sees there. It reads that this company, M-E-C-H-E-L, changes ADR to share ratio. And his shares went up over 200% and then went back down within 24 hours. So let's deal first of all with what is an ADR.
An ADR is an American Depository Receipt. And ADRs have been created to make it easy for Americans to invest in companies, overseas companies, that are not based here in the United States. And ADRs have a lot of flexibility, and each ADR represents a fraction of a share or several shares. What MTL did, let's see, it was issued back in 2004, and it was $21 a share.
Okay.
Got as high as $178 a share. So in essence, what they're doing is you have your one ADR, you're now going to have three ADRs. And why would a company do this? The jargon term is to increase the liquidity. In other words, to make it easier to be buying and selling these shares. Let's say you have an ADR or a stock that's selling at $75 a share.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, a lot of individual investors, they'll walk away from that. That's too expensive. So what companies then do is they create three stocks, $25 a share each. You still have $75 worth of stock. Nothing has changed. But at $25 a share, you know, more people get kind of interested in that. It pops up on their screen. So it increases individual investor buying interest. That's why a company would change its ratio, ADR to share ratio, in order to increase the number of ADRs that were outstanding.
So then what's the deal with the stock suddenly jumping 200% and then going back down within 24 hours?
There, I'm just going to have to make a guess. There are two things. One, that happens all the time. If a U.S. company, $100 a share, splits into four, $25 a share, there'll be an initial pop-up. And it just reflects a flurry of interest. I think it also reflects a recognition that, hey, you know what? The company's doing this from a position of strength. Now it's going to be more shares outstanding. It's going to be traded more. There's going to be more interest here. And then it settles down because everyone goes, well, wait a second. Nothing's really changed. The value is the same. Maybe we might as well back off a little bit.
Okay. Thanks so much for writing in, Vic. If you need us to interpret some financial terms, do visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right. Let's go ahead and hit the phones. And Jerry is with us from Berkeley, California. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
What's your question for Chris today?
Well, it's a question about health insurance and my mother. She's a waitress, and she's not provided health care by her employer. Mm-hmm. And I've been paying for an individual account through Blue Cross for her. And I was wondering if there's any tax benefit to me for providing health care to my mother.
Good question. This is something that he's doing for his mother. So it's not his health care. Is that something that he can deduct on his taxes?
He may be able to take it off on his taxes, but probably not, because you still have to leap that hurdle of 7.5% of your adjusted gross income going toward medical expenses.
To have a health care deduction.
But I think this is a very big and important issue, because at what point can you claim your elderly parent as a dependent?
Oh.
And there are several tests that the government has. For example, this filing year, I believe the figure was the parent couldn't earn more than $3,400 in taxable income. So that would be, you know, above Social Security. That test, by the way, gets waived when it comes to medical. The other test that's very important is that the parent has to get one half of their support from the adult child.
Jerry, how old is your mother?
56.
She's definitely not collecting Social Security at this point.
That's right. But I have a couple recommendations, Jerry. One is that I would actually go with, you know, work with an accountant just to sort of run through the numbers. At what point does this start kicking in?
And that would be for making his mother one of his dependents.
That's right.
There's nothing like an FHA account, is there, that can be used in this context?
There's the health savings accounts and HSA. Now, that's something to definitely be looking into, because you get the tax-free savings.
So how would he go about finding one of those? Is that something where he goes to the insurance company that he's buying his mother's insurance through?
Exactly.
Okay.
And you'd have to check, but I believe the contributions would have to come from her. So he might not be paying into the health savings account. He may be giving her the money as a gift, as cash, and then, you know, she herself is buying the health savings account that way. And it's tax-free when you withdraw it to pay for qualified medical expenses.
Does that help you out, Jerry?
It does.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Well, unfortunately, those are all the calls we can take on this week's show, but Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link there. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks for the great advice, as always.
Thanks, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes did it. So did Eva Longoria and Tony Parker. Just a couple of the celebrity couples who said their vows overseas. But it is not just for Hollywood royalty. More people are skipping the local chapel to say I do in exotic places. The American Wedding Study reports that destination weddings quadrupled just in the last decade. But is it a cheaper route down the aisle? Kristen Bellstrom asked the question in the June issue of Smart Money magazine. So tell us, why are these weddings so popular?
People are just really sort of enamored with this idea of taking their wedding and turning it into a vacation with, you know, 40, 50 of their closest friends and loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also some sociological factors that are playing into this. People are getting married later and later. People are on their second or third marriage. And so the idea of this traditional hometown wedding really doesn't work for everyone anymore. I mean, people are living so far from their family and friends that essentially they figure everyone's going to have to travel anyway. So why not have everyone go to some, you know, great destination?
What is the differential in cost between, you know, your traditional wedding and taking everybody away somewhere?
Well, the average is actually slightly less expensive for a destination wedding. And when you kind of dig into the numbers, it doesn't seem like quite such a good deal. Basically, destination weddings have an average of just 47 guests versus 165 at your traditional wedding. So when you break that number down to the per guest amount spent, it's more than three times as much.
Now, is that the amount spent by the bride and groom?
Yes, that's not factoring in all of the guests' hotel rooms, travel reservations, babysitting, gifts.
I presume that resorts are buying into this.
They sure are. So what resorts are doing is that they've come out with a lot of what they call wedding packages, which are, you know, maybe I'll have the cake, some ceremony, maybe flowers.
Don't you have to deal with all kinds of legal issues, kind of depending where you get married in terms of making sure it's official?
You really have to check carefully into the country's restrictions. Say Jamaica is a pretty simple place. They have a 24-hour waiting period before you can actually marry. In France, that number is up to 40 days
before you
can marry. So there's a lot of sort of behind-the-scenes paperwork that goes into these things.
When you're choosing somewhere to go for your destination wedding, it's not like you can go down to the local hotel ballroom to check it out. Are you just relying on pictures on the web?
Some people do. I'm not sure that I would recommend going that route. The hotels and resorts themselves will offer a planner. You don't usually have to pay anything additional for those people. They're often just one of them per resort. I even talked to one woman, one bride, whose wedding planner doubled as a waitress at the resort. And then you have a sort of separate category, which are people that are just wedding or event planners based in this destination. You will pay more for them. However, the idea is that they have this sort of expertise in putting these kind of events together.
And I guess if you decide to get married in Hawaii, you could really just, you know, sacrifice and pay a visit there before you get married.
More and more hotels and resorts are offering some discounted stays if you want to go and see the resort firsthand. That's not always widely published. So you might, if you're interested in a specific place, you might want to just give them a call and ask if that's a possibility.
Kristen Bellstrom is a staff writer for Smart Money, and her article on destination weddings is in the current issue. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Do write us. And when you do, we like to share your thoughts about the show. A slew of you hurled rotten tomatoes at our stage after Stacey Vanek Smith's story about the cost of growing her own tomatoes. Stacey was trying to put a price on urban gardening, and her startup effort wasn't exactly cheap. For all she spent on seeds and equipment, her Green Acres adventure yielded a fraction of what she could have bought with the same money. But that's exactly what it was, a startup. And Kirk Iverson of Auburn, Alabama, thinks we should have placed more emphasis on the long-term benefits.
With proper care, a trowel will last 10 years, cages at least 5 years. You should also include the health club membership you won't need if you do your own yard work. Maybe a psychologist fees, too, if gardening soothes the soul.
Susan Coe called in from Bryson City, North Carolina, with personal proof that urban gardening pays off.
I managed 1 year to grow 100 pounds of tomatoes in my tiny Los Angeles backyard. I now grow most of my own vegetables. I'm still eating last year's canned, frozen, and dried fruits and veggies, all grown at low cost. If only I could grow wheat for flour.
We'd like photos of the combine rolling down Bryson City's streets, if you do. One of our commentators, Ron Lieber, recently offered new ways to save both time and money on everything from bill paying to, yes, toilet paper. You can actually have your house TP'd by Amazon. Or at least they'll ship TP to your house through a subscription service. Rebecca Hiraday wrote in from New York City to admonish us that ordering things like toilet paper over the internet is, in her words, carbon greedy. We'll roll with that. Speaking of home, I took you on a tour of mine a couple of weeks ago as I learned how to conduct a home inventory. That's when you document everything you own for insurance purposes. I thought we were pretty thorough, but Susan Evans of Minneapolis says we missed one big item as we itemized: the roof over my head.
Here's an extra tip for your home inventory piece. While you're taking inventory of everything inside the house, don't forget the house itself. Videotape your home's physical structure. You'll need to prove that the house itself was in good shape before the disaster, because afterwards, you will be judged.
And finally, Alex Hoffman of Brooklyn judged our recent interview comparing the Apple iPhone 2.0 and the new BlackBerry Bold a little too bold, because, we'll let him explain.
I understand why you might want to talk about the new iPhone and the new BlackBerry this time, but your guest didn't say anything. No one has seen a new iPhone. Will it be bigger, as some rumors say, or will it be smaller, as other rumors say?
Yeah, we got a little eye ahead of ourselves on that one. I apologize. We love getting your comments, compliments, and yes, even criticisms and complaints. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, when the economy gives you lemons, try making low-cal lemonade.
The first thing that's happening is that people aren't eating out as much. And as a nutritionist, that's something that seems really good to me.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, James Richter, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.